Now, did you see the recent TV drama, A Confession, it was called? Now, it was one of the most dramatic true crime cases in recent history. And if, like me, you were shouting at the TV that an injustice had been done, well, you might want to hear what happened firsthand from Karen Edwards, who's the mother of Becky Godden Edwards, who was one of Christopher Halliwell's victims. She's very bravely agreed to come onto the show. So welcome to the Lifestyle Show, Karen.
Hello there. Lovely having you to speak to you.
Oh, bless you. It's great to speak to you. And again, thank you. I know some of the things must be difficult to talk about, but you there is a reason. I mean, you are campaigning quite rightly. So if we can start before we get to what happened, can you tell us a little bit about Becky? What was she like growing up?
Oh, she was an absolute gem of a child. She really was. She was such a happy child, a loving, caring little girl. And she really was a delight. And as she sort of progressed into her school years, she just loved school. Everybody loved Becky. And it started, she started to have problems in the latter years when she went to the senior school and bullying started. Becky was so petite, so tiny, quite shy, quite a withdrawn little girl, really, in comparison to other girls, other friends that she'd had. But everybody loved her. And the bullying started. And she then tried to commit suicide because of the bullying. Mm-hmm. She self-harmed. She obviously overdosed. And that was pretty horrific to see your child doing that. So from the age of 11, she started having traumas, really, in her life. And little did we know that those, that bullying and traumas would develop into drug addiction later on in life.
It's awful.
And anybody who knows anything about drug addiction, it's the most horrendous thing to see a loved one go through. It really is awful. And there's no rhyme or reason. I mean, Becky's reasoning was peer pressure.
Yeah.
And I think she just was... She just didn't know how to handle it. It was really awful to see a child go through that.
Oh, it must have been.
It then made her start developing psychological problems. She was under lots of counsellors and doctors, and but as soon as the drugs were involved, it was like pass the parcel, really. Nobody wanted to get involved, and you have to go on a waiting list. It's just horrendous. And as a parent, to see your child suffering and nobody being able to help you, your hands were tied because I didn't know what to do. I'd never been in this situation. In fact, I can't say that I knew anybody that had ever been on drugs before in my life. So it was a completely new saga to me.
I think the trouble is it gets to the point of no return, doesn't it? It gets to that stage where she then is an addict. She then became addicted. And how does anyone know how to deal with that?
Well, I don't think they do. For a start, you don't really know what the symptoms are. They become quite moody, you know, quite a lot of mood swings, which was, I mean, she was sort of in her teenagers. I mean, most young girls are. They call it hormones. Mm. But what do you define between drug addiction and hormones? Because the temper tantrums, slamming the doors, you know, most teenagers go through that.
Of course.
But you know, it took me a long time because before she started the heroin use, she actually started on CF gases, which they, lots of aerosols were going missing from my cupboards and I couldn't understand where they were going. You know, deodorants, furniture spray, air freshener, the usual things. And then one day I went to, we live on a farm, and I went to the barn, and in the barn was lots of used aerosol cans with the tops, the spray tops taken off, which didn't make any sense to me whatsoever. And I just thought, oh my God, is this what they call aerosol sniffing?
You see,
and
I've
I approached
even heard
Becky
of that.
About this, and she shrugged her shoulders and didn't want to engage in conversation. And her answer when she didn't want to engage in anything was she'd stomp off out.
Yeah.
And You know, again, how do you define that between, you know, that's what a teenage child would do anyway. Most teenage child, you know, children, they do go through little strops, and it was just unbelievable. Being the younger of my two children, I never had any of this with my son. And Becky coming from this sugar and spice and all things nice little girl to this person I didn't know. I couldn't identify this child. And of course, lots of investigating. I then found out she tried to overdose again. It was just as constant. Every day you got up and you were faced with a new problem. And then she started running away, and you'd go out and look for her, and then you'd find her, bring her back, and then she'd run away again. And it just seemed to be a constant battle, and it became the norm in your life. And in amongst all this, you're going to the doctors. A doctor refers them to Drug Link, who was an organisation then that used to help with drug usage. And then you go on a waiting list, and by this time her appointment's arrived, but she's not here because she's run away again. Yeah. And it was just a vicious circle. So later on, I actually found some paraphernalia in her bedroom, which I looked up on the internet. I gave to my brother-in-law to ask him if he could find out any information. And it was that point that I'd found out that she was now using heroin. And it was awful. It was like a silver ball of paper that had been screwed up. There was a rabbit bottle which had a Bic pen sticking and sellotaped to the side of it, which they use as a bong, I think they call them. She had cigarette lighters. And all of this was in this little plastic bag, which was tucked down the back of her bed. And I was in a state of shock when I saw it, and I really didn't know what it was, but I knew it was something quite sinister. And then I found out she was using heroin. It was just horrendous.
I can't even imagine how it must have been for a mother. And even if you had have got this appointment that the doctor recommended, how would you have got her there? I assume she would have refused to go even if she hadn't run away.
Well, at some points, you know, sometimes I used to let her go cold turkey. I would take her, you know, have her in the house, and my son and I, we would take it in turns in watching her. So she would go cold turkey. She would have the drug withdrawal, which is not a pleasant sight to actually see that happening. But I just didn't know what to do. I was giving her sleeping tablets to try and help her. It was just, my head was in such a state, I really didn't know what to do. And you really didn't feel there was any advice out there to help you.
Yeah, what a shame.
When this was happening, I mean, it was several years ago, and the drugs weren't really that well known as they are today. But she had been bullied at school. She had a breakdown, and she then had to go into an interim school. In this interim school, she was then introduced to heroin. So she had fallen in with a bad crowd. It was just a nightmare. It's every parent's nightmare.
Of course.
That your child, you know, if they go down that wrong road,
yeah.
What do you do?
Yeah.
They don't give you a handbook when that child's born. But every child is individual. I had two children, and they were so opposites. It was just unbelievable.
Yeah, you can't control it. No,
you can't control it. You really can't control it. But even the times that I got Becky there, you know, you'd go there, and they would want a urine sample, and then they said, right, we'll make you an appointment. Come back whenever. By this time, she was gone again. Mm. So it was a no-win situation, really. And the times I knocked on the door with her, with me and my sister, and I would say, I want somebody to see her today. Oh, well, I'm sorry. I said, let me pay for somebody to see her today. It would be, oh, no, you know, we're an organisation that's run charity-based organisation. You can't jump the queue. Which, you know, at the end of the day, if they're a charity-based organisation, surely they would welcome the money to do the urine test or whatever test that they had to do there and then.
Yeah.
But no, they wouldn't. I mean, that organisation doesn't exist anymore. Surprise, surprise.
Well, yeah.
I think there is another one that's taken over, but it's just a vicious circle. And, you know, my heart goes out to any family or anybody who has a loved one that's addicted to drugs. The same with alcohol. It's an addiction. And it's really awkward to try and break that cycle, because the only person really, I mean, they're hurting you, but they're also hurting themselves. I mean, Becky used to steal things from the home to go and sell to feed that addiction.
Yeah.
But she didn't like doing that. But
no.
It was the only way that she could survive. And the only people that they hurt are themselves. They really are hurting themselves, and they find themselves in a situation and they don't know how to get out of it.
Was there any point, Karen, where Becky came to you and said, I want to get off these drugs, I want to do something about it?
Yes. It's just awful. It's just awful. They really, they're stuck. You know, it's this vortex that's sucking you in, and
yeah.
You really don't know what the next step's going to be. I picked her up from the street sometimes, and she was in a dreadful state.
Yes.
She'd been sleeping rough. She had her own bedroom. She had everything a young girl of her age would have dreamed of. You know, her own bedroom, her own ensuite, you know, a mother to hand that would have helped her, grandparents, aunties, you know, just everybody was there to support her, but she chose drugs over her family. I do believe that one day she would have turned her life around, but unfortunately her drug addiction becomes so desperate that she started selling her body to pay for her drugs.
Which is an illness.
You know, she hated herself even more so for.
I'm sure she
so
did.
It's a dreadful situation, and now I see drug addicts and I look at them in a completely different light. Whereas before, people that are not used to it, it frightens some people. You think that they've come from a bad family. You know, all sorts of things run through your mind. But sometimes they find themselves in this situation and they don't know how to get out of it. They're digging a big hole and they really don't know how to get out. There's not enough help for them.
Do you think changed now, all these years later?
This is now. I mean, now there's not enough help for people.
No. Okay, yeah.
There's just not enough help. And the drug addiction is growing. It's a bit like the National Health Service. The amount of people that are demanding the National Health Service's usage, there's not enough doctors to go around. And, you know, as the world's getting bigger, you know, so is the population, and we're not there. We cannot accommodate everybody.
Yeah, I agree. Well, sadly, you lost touch with Becky for 8 years, and as we saw on the drama, you never gave up trying to contact her. How old was she when she disappeared?
She was 20. It was just before her 21st birthday. The last time I saw Becky was in the December, and she obviously went missing. She never come home for Christmas. We sat and waited thinking it was going to be, you know, she'll be back, even though her last words to me were, Mum, I can't keep putting you through this. I'll come home when I'm clean. She kissed me and I watched her walk away. That was really hard.
I'm sure.
But I never thought that would be the last time that I would ever see Becky.
No.
And as you say, you know, it was all those years. And 2011, after a local taxi driver had been arrested for the murder of another young girl that had been taken from Swindon and murdered by him, I had a knock on my door to say there was a second body that he had admitted to, and that second body was my daughter.
Yeah.
And it was the most horrendous thing that every, you know, any parent had to endure. It'd been a battle. It hadn't just been a few years. It'd been a long, long time. And then to be told that your daughter had been found murdered, it was pretty horrendous.
Oh, I'm sure it was, Karen. I like I say, I can't imagine. And a lot of our listeners will have seen the programme. Some won't. So just sort of to fill in the blanks for them, the other missing girl was Sean O'Callaghan. She was found. And then Detective Steve Fulcher, who I think was treated appallingly.
Absolutely. Gracefully.
Can you explain what happened? It was something to do with pace. He didn't go by the right laws of the land, but if he hadn't have done, you'd have never got Becky home.
Yes. I mean, what had happened was when Sian was missing, she went missing on the 19th of March, 2011. The police had a tail, you know, they after lots of watching and trying to suss out who had taken Sian, because she was a missing person, they suspected this taxi driver. And then they said they still believed, Defaulter still believed he was a lead investigating officer. He still believed that Sian O'Callaghan was still alive and she'd been kidnapped and was held hostage. So she still had a right to life, naturally. And when Christopher Halliwell was eventually arrested, he was given a caution, which is a terrorist caution. They do not have the right to remain silent because there is a life at risk. So once they had arrested him, he showed them where Sian was. He'd been read his rights then. He had the right to remain silent. On the way back to the police station, he said, "Normal people don't go around killing. I'm a sick person. Do you want another one?" And Steve Fulcher was quite astounded. You know, I don't think there's any officer in the land that's ever been found to be in that situation. So he said, "Yes, show me." So because he didn't then read Christopher Halliwell's rights, he asked him to show him where the second body was, took him to a remote part of the countryside, helicopters above, as it was in the drama, and Halliwell got out of the car. He paced so many steps, found a dip in the wall. He said, "She's buried there." So obviously, as you see in the drama, they dug, they found the second person, Halliwell, that was then taken back to the police station and given a solicitor. But because he wasn't taken back to the police station, after he admitted that there was a second body, Steve Fulcher had breached Halliwell's human rights.
No, for goodness sake.
So because Halliwell's human rights were breached, that meant that Steve Fulcher was going to be in trouble. And was he in trouble?
Yeah,
my golly, was he in trouble?
Yeah, yeah.
It was awful. So the rights of Christopher Halliwell overtook the rights, really, of Steve Fulcher, but not only Steve Fulcher, the rights of Becky. Because if he had been taken back to the police station, he remains silent for months and months and months.
Yeah, yeah.
It wasn't until Sian's case that he admitted her case was about to be heard, and he admitted guilt. But Becky's name by this time had also been dropped from the indictment because of the rights of Halliwell superseding the rights of Steve Fulcher and Becky.
So
that meant then that Becky was not even in the equation. He had murdered her and she was a nothing. And he was never going to stand trial for her murder.
It's crazy, because if Steve Fulcher had done what they say that is the right thing, I mean, I do believe the law is an ass in a lot of cases, but if Steve Fulcher had done the right thing and cautioned him and taken him back, of course he would have seen the solicitor, and the solicitor would have said, "Don't say anything." And then,
absolutely, which is what he did as soon as he arrived back at the police station.
Yeah,
so Becky would have never have been found. I would never have been sat here telling the story.
Yeah.
I would have never been able to have written a book. Now, you know, eventually, I went out during those years campaigning. I went to Downing Street. I met the Justice Minister. I met David Cameron's second in command. I kept going and going and going until the law of the land would actually look at Becky's case, which they did.
Yeah.
And in 2016, Christopher Halliwell was then... There was a court case and he was charged for Becky's murder. Not only was he charged with Becky's murder, he was actually given a whole life tariff, which means that Christopher Halliwell will never, ever come out of prison, ever. So he will never, ever be able to pick up his career where he left off and continue his murdering spree, because he would have been let out. He would have been out amongst us, amongst our children, our loved ones, our daughters, sisters, it's just horrendous. Again, it comes down to the law of the land. I mean, Robert Buckland, who is our MP, and he helped me with the campaign. He was amazing. He is now quite high up in the Parliament, and he is an ex-criminal law barrister himself, and he is seeing that the law will be more for the victim and not for the perpetrator of the crime. So he's introducing harsher sentences for people. And I'm afraid I've got to back him 100%.
Yeah.
Because if somebody takes the life of your loved one, then they should pay that price. They should never be allowed out on the streets again. And I just feel that I've not actually grieved Becky. I've not had a chance to. And then suddenly last year, I lost my husband.
Oh, Karen, and I'm so sorry.
It was, you know, just somebody else. And it's just been an absolute nightmare. It really has. And writing my book was very cathartic. Mm. And I did start writing the book before the drama. So the book was running alongside the same time as the drama. And Jeff Pope, who actually wrote the drama, he went round all the individual people that was involved in the drama, including the police and the Crown Prosecution. You know, he really did do his research. And we all told him, you know, about Becky's life, Sian's life, you know, what we had to endure, everything. And he then went back and wrote the drama. And I think he did an absolutely phenomenally incredible job of the drama.
Yeah, I agree with you. A lot of people were hooked. They really were. Can I ask you what happened to Steve Fulcher, Karen?
Well, at the moment, he's not working. He was in Somalia because that's the only place he could find a job. And we all know that that is a very, very dangerous place to work. And I think our police service in Wiltshire here is absolutely disgraceful. To treat him in the way he did, they did. It was awful. I mean, like the drama, they all stabbed him in the back. One minute he was a hero.
Yeah.
He went from hero to zero overnight. And it was an absolute disgrace, the way he was treated. We want policemen like him protecting us.
Yeah.
We don't want police out there that are there to feather their own nests. We want people to look after us. That's what we pay our taxes for.
Yeah, quite right.
And I think that we need protecting. We need protecting. I mean, it's just unbelievable. There's a man who was absolutely passionate about his job. I mean, he knew he was sailing very close to the wind when he arrested Halliwell and did what he did. But had he not done what he did, then Becky would still be led out in that field. We would still be in a situation as Joan Lawrence. She doesn't know where her daughter Claudia is, and she's been missing for 20 years.
Yeah, it's also the fact that I think he had to make a split-second decision. He didn't have time to think, did he?
Absolutely. And he wasn't the lone ranger out there doing all this on his own. His superiors were also helping him along the way. You know, it wasn't just, oh, I've got to go out and arrest Halliwell. There were other police officers with him. He didn't do it on his own. It was a decision that everybody made that, you know, now we've got to arrest him, because it had been 5 days and Sian could be almost dead. I mean, they were watching Halliwell for days, trying to wait for him to take them to where Sian may have been.
Mm.
But he suspected at one point, as you saw in the drama, and he slipped the net. No, he left the police. They'd lost him. And here is a devious man who I truly believe, even though he's not been convicted as being a serial killer, I truly believe he is. With the evidence that I have given the Wiltshire Police, North Yorkshire Police, other police forces, that I've given evidence to, because people were saying to me, the police are not listening to us.
Yeah.
We've reported this to the police, we've reported that to the police, and they were not listening. As far as they were concerned, Halliwell is in prison, and I don't think they're worrying about convicting him for any other murders.
Yeah. Sadly, I hate to do this, Karen, I could talk to you for hours, but we are sadly running out of time. PACE is Police and Criminal Evidence Act, and I know you've been a campaigner for change to this law, which is what happened to this poor guy, Steve Fulcher.
Absolutely. There's lots of grey areas in PACE. And Damien Green, who was the Justice Minister at the time, who I saw, he said, PACE is a living document and it needs to be looked at. And it seriously does need to be looked at.
Mm.
And like I said, you know, when I wrote this book, I can't go into all details on the phone because we haven't got enough time.
I wish we did.
But,
we did.
I could talk for England because there's so much knowledge in my head. But it needs to be looked at.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, my local MP who's in Parliament said that it's not finished with yet and he is still going to consider looking at PACE.
Well, that's excellent news. And a lot of that, I know, is down to you. The book is called A Killer's Confession, The Untold Story Behind ITV's A Confession, just so as people know. It's by Karen Edwards, who we're speaking to now, and we're selling it on our website, tre.radio. Karen, I wish you well. Thank you so much for coming on to talk to us today. I know it must have been hard. I think you're incredible. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for inviting me.
Take care now. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.